For a rabbi to preach about the Passover Seder on the final day of Pesach, a Yisker sermon no less, is, to say the very least, of questionable judgment. Like candy corn purchased the day after Halloween, no matter how tasty it may be, its arrival comes a little, too late. So I beg your forgiveness and your indulgence from the outset as I share with you my 2017 insights on the Haggadah, thoughts which will do you no good for this year's festival, now in its waning hours, but will, I promise, hope to serve you well next year, and I hope, like the Afikoman itself, a small morsel to help frame the sacred hour of Yisker for which we have gathered. Just before the holidays, our community was treated to a pre-Passover shiur, a session taught by my beloved and honored teacher, Rabbi Dr. J.J. Schachter, professor of Jewish history and Jewish thought, and senior scholar at Yeshiva University's Center for the Jewish Future. Amongst Rabbi Schachter's many insights that evening was his suggestion that embedded within the Haggadah are numerous references, oblique and obvious, exoteric and esoteric, to the biblical figure of Joseph. Since his session, I've had the pleasure of reading an article Rabbi Schachter wrote on the very subject, enumerating all the places in the Haggadah, the story of our people's liberation from bondage, that make veiled or open reference to Joseph, a figure whom, at first glance, has no role in the story of our people's liberation. I'll begin with the most well-known, a reference which, perhaps due to its being a later addition in the Haggadah, Rabbi Schachter doesn't make mention, and that is Echad Asra Mi Yodea, who knows 11? We know 11. Asara Kochvaya, 11 stars. The story behind the 11 stars, like the 11 stars of Van Gogh's famed Starry Night, is never made explicit. But anyone with passing familiarity with the Joseph story understands it to be the 11 stars of Joseph's youthful and indelicately relayed dreams foretelling his brother's deference to him. From here, the references become a bit more hidden. The Talmud explains that in the time of the temple, the meat of the Passover sacrifice was to be carried home, being swung over one's shoulders. Why in this particular manner, the Talmud asks? Because it is in the manner of Derech Socharim Yishmaelim, in keeping with the manner of the Yishmaelite merchants, the ones responsible for Joseph's arrival in Egypt. In other words, a paschal offering is meant not only to reference a sacrifice signaling Israel's redemption from Egypt, but also help focus on the near sacrifice of Joseph, whose sail down to Egypt marked the beginning of our Egyptian sojourn. As for the Haggadah passage, Avadim Hayinu Lefaro B'Mitzrayim, we were slaves to Pharaoh in Egypt, Rabbi Schachter cites rabbinic precedent that this verse may be understood to reference not just the Pharaoh of Moses' era, but that of Joseph's era, and that it is his transformation from servant to freeman that we are describing. How about karpas, the green that is dipped in the salt water? As any Hebrew school student will tell you, the salt water represents the tears of the slave, and the act of dipping signals the luxury of being a free man or woman. Rabbi Schachter, in unpacking the rabbinic sources, demonstrates an alternative, less well-known tradition, namely that the dipping is meant to remind us of the brothers' dipping of Joseph's coat of many colors in the goat's blood to fool their father Jacob into thinking that Joseph had been devoured by a wild animal. In fact, Rabbi Schachter discusses a less well-known tradition of dipping the karpas in the traditionally red charoset, all but making explicit the intimate connection between our Seder dipping and the original sin of Joseph's brothers. Other references abound. Why four cups? Traditionally, of course, we think of the four cups to refer to four different verbs in Exodus describing God's mighty acts of redemption. Vehotzeiti, vehitzalti, vega'alti, velakachti. While this explanation may indeed be true, both the Midrash and the Talmud suggest that the four cups refers to the four times the Hebrew word for cup, kos, is used when Joseph interprets the dreams of Pharaoh's butler in prison. And while the list continues, and I've left copies of the article for you to read outside, as with all things, the question eventually becomes, so what? Namely, if there is indeed a thread of Joseph, technicolor, seen and unseen, woven into the tapestry of our Haggadah, if the learned reader and discerning eye is meant to be ruminating on Joseph while eating their gefilte fish of freedom, why exactly should that be? What lesson would it teach? And it's at this point, while I readily acknowledge and my debt to my teacher, Rabbi Schachter, I humbly offer an explanation different than that of my beloved teacher. The Haggadah, we know, spends the bulk of its time on the story of the liberation of our people, giving short thrift to the tale of our descent into servitude. That story, the final 13 chapters of Genesis, is a story of Joseph, and it's not a pretty one. It is a tale of paternal neglect, fraternal strife, betrayal, trauma, deceit, deception, and abandonment. Nobody's hands, not Joseph's, not Jacob's, and certainly not those of the brothers, are clean. It would be enough, Dayenu, were we only to focus on the dysfunction of our first biblical family as a prime mover resulting in our Egyptian sojourn. The close reader of the Joseph story further knows, and knows full well, that it was none other than Joseph who, in saving Egypt from the effects of famine, would unwittingly set into motion an economy of debt slavery that arguably gave rise to the slave culture of hundreds of years henceforth. No Joseph, no Egypt. No Egypt, no slavery. No slavery, no redemption. At the most basic level, the tale of Joseph is in the Haggadah because it's a necessary prequel, the story of how we got there in the first place. But that is just the beginning. It goes deeper. Important as it is, and it is, to tell the story of our glorious redemption, of God's mighty hand and outstretched arm, we dare not sit down at the Seder without at least giving a knowing nod, some sort of recognition, spoken or perhaps just understood, that we know the circumstances precipitating our people's descent into slavery. We know that the story is complicated. We know that we could have been better, that everyone could have been better. The presence of Joseph at the Seder table is important because it demands of us that we confront the difficult aspects of our family story. The descent must be told, not at the expense of redemption, but because in so doing, the telling of our redemption gains authenticity and meaning. In so doing, we communicate to ourselves, to each other, and perhaps even to God, that we are capable of learning from our mistakes and thus worthy of forgiveness and redemption. Lest we forget, the final song of the Seder table, the strangest of all, Chad Gad Yah, is a folk song about a goat, a kid that was killed by the cat, then the dog, then the stick, and so on and so forth. It may be a stretch, but could it be that Chad Gad Yah is the final wink to our Joseph? Was it not the slaughter of a kid, in Hebrew Seir Izim, in Aramaic Gad Yah, that set everything in motion in the first place? By this telling, the song and the Seder end with the appearance of the Kadosh Baruch Hu, the Holy One, blessed be He, a culminating theological catharsis of sorts, having faced our past, told our story, and now as free men and women, ready to move forward with hope to the promised land. There is no family that is untouched by complexity, not even, especially not even, the family of our biblical forefathers. And when faced with that complexity, perhaps even trauma, we could, if we so chose, shove it under the rug, a strategy of avoidance that any therapist will tell you will serve only to perpetuate that anxiety and leave us further psychologically incapacitated. Far healthier than avoidance is to ask how we can, in spite of that complexity or perhaps even trauma, rebuild. The first step inevitably involves retelling our story in the supportive presence of our loved ones. It need not be plastered on a billboard. It serves neither us nor our loved ones to wave the flag of our imperfections too publicly. But we must pause to give them their due, to respect them, to learn from them, and to grow from them. At this time of Yizkor, we recall our loved ones, lives filled with loving, redemptive, beautiful scenes. Those whom we recall have built us up, made us who we are, and our debt of gratitude to them is immense and immeasurable, beyond what we could ever repay. We also know that there is no life lived, and certainly not any relationship, that is without its imperfections. We all know that our loved ones, that we ourselves have been guilty, like Joseph's family, of a misspoken word, a careless deed, or a caustic remark. Like the Seder table itself, Yizkor affords us the opportunity to sit in the supportive presence of family and friends to acknowledge our people's moments of glorious redemption and wished-for do-overs, all with an eye towards moving forward. We reflect and express our gratitude for the love, for the wisdom, the care that our loved ones have extended to us. And no doubt for some of us, perhaps many of us, we are also aware of the complexities, the places, the times that I could have been better, when our loved ones could have been better, when we should have all been better. It need not be spoken. We don't need to wave any flag. It's understood without being made explicit. But it's important, critically important, to acknowledge, because it is in that acknowledgement that we become wiser, that we become stronger, that we develop the tools towards a nuanced understanding of our loved ones, their wonderful and their not so wonderful aspects. Yizkor does not ask of us to remember only good people, nor only the good of people. Yizkor serves as an opportunity for the living to construct a place in our hearts where the memory of a person can be held without that memory incapacitating us, impeding our forward momentum. As the children of Israel departed from Egypt, with Pharaoh in pursuit, without even enough time for the dough to rise, when every second counted, Moses, the Torah explains, paused to fulfill a vow, a task imposed on him by the generations prior. What was the task, so important, so critical, with history hanging in the balance, that Moses had to fulfill? Moses, the Torah explains, went back to gather the remains of Joseph. He couldn't leave. Israel couldn't leave. The redemption couldn't happen if he did not demonstrate to himself, to his people, and to God that the lessons and legacy of Joseph were not somehow integrated into their present movement and forward momentum. The remains of Joseph, the Midrash explained, were no burden. Just the opposite. They were the means, the vehicle by which the redemption would happen. In the years to come, it would be Joseph's legacy, in its imperfections and imperfections, as much as the Ten Commandments themselves, that would guide Israel. Today marks the conclusion of Passover. Before we leave, before our redemption is complete, we too pause to gather our thoughts, to remember our loved ones, to build a place for them in our hearts, a place worthy of honoring them, a place that's not insistent on idealizing them, a place capable of keeping them close to us on our journey forward. Not in the Bible, not at our Seder, and not in our own lives, may we progress forward without remembering how we got there in the first place. In loss, in hope, and please God in healing, may we all merit to sit together next year in Jerusalem. Amen.